Just listen to this. I'm not going to do anything better than Earth, Wind, and Fire. Guarantee you that.
Wouldn't it be so cool if we could just play a song? I mean, if we were...
Dude, when I first started the show, I would end every show with a song. You know me. Then it was three.
Like Stairway to Heaven.
Then it was five. And my old boss, Jeff Allen, had to be treat me with kid gloves because I was brand new at this. I didn't know what I was doing. And I was being really successful, like right out of the box, the kind of lightning in the bottle. And he'd be like, so... It's a talk show, and we should talk as much as we can. I'm like, oh, I'm just playing some tunes.
They're talking when they're singing the lyrics. Come on.
Want to hear a couple kind of cool paranormalish kind of things?
Yes.
There is not a new theory, but a theory that is gaining some traction with actual people, not just conspiracy theory guys who live in their mom's basement, but that some of the disappearances that happened in the U.S. national parks are from feral humans, not Bigfoot.
Right, right.
Feral humans that date back to the Civil War, that in the Civil War, you had deserters who would just go into the wild country, into the bush, and live. And that generation after generation, they became more and more feral, where they have their own language and everything, and their skin's different. That's fascinating.
Have you seen I forget the guy's name, but there's a guy on TikTok who's either making a documentary about it or writing a book.
Could be where I got
it. And he's got videos, like he posts videos all the time of like he's got cameras out. He's got cameras outside of his RV or something. And you'll see these people come up and they mess with things or they leave things behind or whatever.
Yikes.
Yeah. I think feral humans are scarier to me than just about anything.
I mean,
that's terrifying.
Yeah. If they're actually feral, do they do that and just like, we want to scare everybody away so they don't mess with us?
Yeah.
Are they like,
either way,
like Nell?
I think like Nell, but dirtier and mean.
Okay.
Like take your baby, Nell, kind of thing.
Yikes.
I can think of one baby they can take, though.
Yeah.
No.
Jeez. Who wants to be kidnapped by feral humans?
Jeez.
Me. Okay.
No way.
The other thing, I'm reading a book. I read now voraciously.
Bragger.
Sebastian Younger is the author of The Perfect Storm. And war correspondent, just kind of an all-around stud, handsome dude. And he almost died a few years ago. And he was literally like on death's door. And he was in the hospital room. And he looked to his left and he saw the pit, which a lot of people see. And he just knew he was going into the pit. He knew he was dying. The doctors were talking as if he was dying. And then he saw his father. And his father was telling him, it's okay. I got you. It's going to be all right. But what I found fascinating about this account, because I used to go to NDERF.org, stands for something, and it's all thousands of near-death experiences, and I used to read them all the time. So I've heard this a gazillion times, but I've never heard this one, and I've always thought about this. He was not close with his dad. I loved my dad, but I wouldn't say that we were close. And if I were to be dying and my dad showed up, living Dave feels like I'd be like intimidated. It wouldn't be peaceful. And he said that. It's like when he was in the dying process and his dead father showed up to take him to the other side, he wasn't like, Daddy. He was like, oh, it's that old man that was mean to me and neglected me as a child. Mm. Isn't that fascinating?
Oh, yeah. Very. Yeah, that is.
Because he said, I was thinking, why you? Why did you show up? But think about how many people have complicated relationships with parents or grandparents or siblings. And if when you're in the dying process, one of them shows up and you're like kind of off put. What a fascinating concept.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. What do you mean when you say the pit? I don't know about this.
So a lot of people will either see or end up in this bottomless pit.
Like they're going to hell?
Yeah. Or just separation from God or separation from the universe. Just like you're there. It's forever. Give up all hope, ye who enter here, kind of things. And then you'll hear a lot of NDEs where people will pray and then they'll see a pinprick of light and the light will get bigger and Jesus will save them whatever deity they happen to believe in. It's pretty fascinating.
Interesting.
And we've learned recently in the last couple of years, because I can't believe they hadn't done experiments like this, but they had a couple of people who were hooked up to a brain machine and they died. like an MRI or something like that.
Oh.
And there was a spike in brain activity 30 seconds before death and 30 seconds after. So after clinical death, the brain would spike.
Huh.
And it was the part of the brain that deals with dreams and visualization. And so agnostics and atheists would say, like, well, here it is. There's your answer. Is for whatever reason, you know, like if you have ever really hurt yourself really bad and it doesn't hurt because your body releases all these endorphins and serotonin, and then an hour later you're in racking pain, but it gets you through it. You know, evolutionary makes sense, I guess. But humanists would say it's just brain activity. It's just trying to make it easier on you to die. But then, as a humanist, I would say, well, who cares? Because if you're dying, you know, I mean, why?
Right.
Why would you internally care about that? And then religious people, of course, say, well, that's just they pierced the veil and then modern technology brought them back.
If you believe that you just kind of go back into the universe when you die, that makes sense to me, that it's kind of like your brain just like dumping all of that back into everything.
Pretty cool, though, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's all I had until 5 p.m.
Okay.
Well, there you go. That's
Let's
it.
Talk about the baby some more. Because I have more
I know, that's all you hear that baby finally got
gonna,
her
like,
dream vacation?
Under it.
Wonder if that... I don't understand. I don't understand anything.
You're not letting it go, are you?
No, I'm never going
to
let that go.
Why does it make you so mad? Why does it upset you so much to see the baby have something
It's not
nice?
That. No.
Be jealous of the baby?
He's mad at the media.
I'm mad at the headline of it. Like, this is an infant.
Uh-huh.
The infant's not dreaming about going to a vacation at a hotel.
I also got really mad at another guy last night. I got to stop watching TikTok. It was one of these guys. So when I get a sweet tooth, I reach for an apple. I'm like, F off.
Yeah.
Apples suck compared to Kit Kats.
I will drop kick you in the knee.
Yeah.
I will knock your knee
Just
completely
stop talking.
Out.
It's like Tom Brady. Like, on a cheat day, I might eat a strawberry.
Oh, man.
Just
I think that's
punch
when I.
You in the face,
that's
dude.
When I started hating him.
Yeah. That's one of the most mad I've ever seen, Dave.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember the strawberry day. Everyone was having a meltdown.
Oh.
You're going to cheat and eat some fruit.
We all almost trashed the studio. We were getting so upset.
Every other human on the planet is like, that's a good, healthy snack.
Oh.
And he's like, it's cheating.
Yeah, you'd have to dare me to eat a strawberry.
I don't have the jealousy hating of Tom Brady. Like, I don't care.
Oh, I do.
I don't care that he's successful and he's made a lot of money and he's good looking. What I hate about him is his attitude about things like that. Or like his whole, boy, you know, I'm really sad that this roast impacted my family. Like, yeah, idiot. We all knew it would. You're the only dummy that didn't think that there would be something in there that might make your kid sad.
Well, he's just so removed from the common man and is so used to things going his way that I'm sure whenever it's like, oh, a consequence to an action, this is uncomfortable. Like,
you know what a new study says is terrible for men? Fathering children.
What?
What?
New study says that men who have kids and care, not men who have kids and then take off, but men who have kids and raise them, that it doesn't seem to be bad for the moms, but it's terrible for the men.
Like health-wise?
Health-wise.
Oh, okay.
Just anxiety and depression and heart attacks and all sorts of things. Hmm. You die younger if you have kids. That's what the new study says.
Hmm.
Well, it's hard to imagine a bigger stressor than being responsible for another living being. So,
speaking of,
well, not only that, it's a thing you care
Seinfeld
about more than
audio?
You care about yourself.
Right.
We do have the Seinfeld audio.
Have you heard this?
Only what he was editing. I haven't heard the full thing.
Okay, so Seinfeld went from nowhere to he's out there about everything, about Palestine and Gaza. And so he is talking about his movie, which was set in the 60s, and talks about how the reason we're having trouble now is that men aren't dominating and there's no hierarchy.
I miss a dominant masculinity.
I couldn't help but wonder if part of it is maybe your own nostalgia for this time that feels like another planet or at least another country.
Well, of course it does. But there's another element there that I think is the key element, and that is an agreed upon hierarchy, which I think is absolutely vaporized in today's moment.
Okay.
And I think that is why people lean on the horn and drive in the crazy way that they drive. because we have no sense of hierarchy. And as humans, we don't really feel comfortable like that. So that is part of what I think is, if you want to talk about nostalgia, that's part of what makes that moment attractive looking back. Hmm.
Then he goes on to say that he always wanted to be a real man, but he didn't achieve it. But when he was growing up, you had JFK and Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. Those were his examples, not mine.
Howard Cosell.
And he's like, those were real men, and we just don't have real men anymore.
Really?
And so he's taking a lot of crap for saying things like we need dominant males and we need a hierarchy. But
yeah, the hierarchy, I was trying to understand what he was trying to say with that.
So I took it that it wasn't just men are above women and women are above kids. I think it was like your boss is above you and you show respect to your boss. Okay. And he shows respect to his boss. And, you know, the trains ran on time in the 60s. I think that's what he was trying to say.
Okay. I think that part I took as kind of what we were getting at earlier with rules, right? Like people now just exempt themselves from certain rules of society where in the past that didn't happen. And that part I kind of agree with. I don't understand the other part. I don't get it. I mean, first of all, Jerry Seinfeld. I mean, Jerry is, I mean, I get it when like the big tough guys think that because that's kind of how they're wired. But Jerry, I don't know, man. I think that question that was asked of him, though, is the good one. It's because when you're young, everything seems better. When you're younger, you don't see the problems of the world and you look at it and you're like, everybody's like, where's John Wayne now? John Wayne was a fake guy. He was an actor. He wasn't actually a soldier. He wasn't actually like, going out and performing special ops in the world. I mean, he might have been a tough guy, but I mean, he was mostly acting like one in movies. And I think we overdid that back then, like overplayed it. And now people remember it. And they're like, that's what it was. I'm like, no, I think there are bigger problems. I think the biggest reason.
I wonder what people in the 50s and 60s pined for.
You know, that's a good question.
Because if you're thinking people like the kids, the baby boomer kids in the 50s, like, oh, look at them with their rock and roll.
Yeah.
And in the 60s with the hippies, I wonder what they were saying. Like, my dad worked in the coal mine when he was, a zygote. I mean.
I think that. Every generation of humans has thought the ones after them are less tough. When you say, and by the way, it's because we all have it less tough than the people before us, right? The settlers had it tougher than the people that came after them. And then the next generation had it a little easier. And then the next one a little easier because you're building upon the work of your predecessors. Mm-hmm. That's how human beings have worked with technology, with learning, with education. So what we're standing on is a mountain of information that started to be gathered tens of thousands of years ago. And the people that are coming after us are going to stand on top of what we put on top of the pile. So, of course, you know, we didn't have to figure out how to start a fire. That was solved a long time ago.
Our grandkids will probably work a 2 or 3 day week. And they'll be like, oh, here goes Grandpa Dave.
Look at these wimps.
5 days.
Well, it's interesting because it feels like that. It feels like this is the first generation that I'm seeing, particularly of adults, who it felt like in the past it was always you work very hard so that your children and those who come after you have a better life.
Yeah, right.
You want your kids to have a 2-day week. That would be ideal. You want your kids to make more money than you, have a better life, get their tuitions paid for, whatever. And it feels like there's a lot of people in these current generations that are like holding on, like almost getting. Instead of feeling that like happiness,
feeling
relief,
resentful,
feeling resentful and bitter of maybe things being better for those who come after them.
I'm one of those parents in the first bucket. If my kids worked 2-day weeks and had more time for themselves and with their family, like great.
It's interesting.
Makes you a good parent.
That's me. That's my dad, too. My dad loves that his kids are doing they want to do and all that stuff.
Oh, mine were old school.
Yeah. But what's interesting to me, though, is like I've had this discussion with him in the past where we'd talk about sports and he's so mad about how much money Major League Baseball players are making. I said, would you be mad if it was me making it? And it stopped the conversation because you're not thinking of it that way. And I think that's what happens on the larger scale is you're not thinking of it as good things for your kids. You're thinking of all the easy things for people you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm,
and that's an easier thing to be angry about as opposed to saying, well, you know, if it was my family member, I don't think I would resent the fact that they make $20 million a year. I'd probably be happy for them.
Yeah. 225 DGS. Ricky Horton's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. Well, so much for Rachel's good girl image.
What are we talking
parking
about?
Parking tickets?
Oh, yeah. I have a parking ticket. I got one in November. The first time I went to Japan, I just parked. You know, like in the city, it's like, don't park here on the first Tuesday of the month. Well, I was gone for 2 weeks, and it was the beginning of the month, and I got a parking ticket. And, of course, I didn't pay it, so I'm sure it's like $100 now. Got another parking ticket when I was up in Midtown a couple weeks ago. When am I going to pay these off? Nobody truly knows. Mm. But the thing that's really weighing on my mind is my stickers are expiring again, even though I just got them last summer. It's so dumb. Mm. And they send it to me in the mail and they're like, if you have a code on the card, then you don't have to come in. Well, of course I don't have a code. So I have to go to the actual DMV and I have until like June 25th or something.
And you have to pay your tickets first?
No, it's just kind of all rolled together into one big thing of stress for me, right? Exactly. Like, it's just a lot going on. So, would anyone like to make a bet on whether or not these things actually get
done? I'm going to say you're riding dirty for a month or two. Speaking of...
The problem with the parking thing, though, is it can lead to more parking tickets.
I know. I got to get on that.
You still dirty?
That's a big question, Dave. There's a lot wrong with me. Yes. Oh, yeah. I can't get it fixed. Because I can't pass an emissions test because my car is a big junkie, and so they won't have me. I've been there before, and I've been like, listen, I gotta get right with Johnny Law here. You gotta help me out. And they are unwilling to.
It's shocking
to see my side
the
of things.
The DMV.
Yeah, they're unwilling to bend on their rules. So we're on.
Man, it's been a while since I've been in that line, but you've got. All your paperwork, triple checked, and you know good and GD well that you're missing one thing.
Yep.
And they know it too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame,
two more.
You deserve this ice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome back, guys. Time to talk to our pal Ricky Horton. What's up, Rick?
Hey, Dave. How are you today? What's going on?
You enjoying your day off?
Oh, I am. Yeah, I'm actually back here in St. Louis and just enjoying being back home. I'm going to fly back to Philadelphia for the rest of the road trip, but enjoying the last of the cicadas here.
I can't believe you're not out clubbing with Rooney tonight.
Well, I was second on my list, and being home for a day was first on my list, so it's all good.
I can't just see it. Can't see Rooney in a big douche.
These two guys like the Night at the Roxbury.
Hey, I remember him in his early 20s, so you'd be surprised what I remember about John Rooney.
You need to ditch some dirt at some point, man. That's I love it.
I'm on the down low, I will, yeah.
So, Rick, we had a good discussion with Wheels and Ranji in the first segment talking about the integration, no pun intended, of the MLB stats, the Negro League stats. Any strong opinions on this?
Yeah, no, I'm all for that. I mean, it's kind of an embarrassment, obviously, that it wasn't thought about earlier. And I will say this, there's a complexity to doing it because you got to get apples and oranges, and numbers are so important to baseball people. So I kind of get the problems that they had doing that. Certainly, the first step that they did, that they actually gave them, you know, big league service time and all that, that was done a few years ago. That was paramount to do that. That was even more important, I would say.
Rick, do you know one thing that I've argued for a long time, because, you know, I mean, I'm a like baseball history nerd, and I grew up reading about the numbers, but then I also ended up growing up and reading about the human beings. And nobody just goes and looks at the record books. And I don't understand why people get mad about that when the story of the person, right? The story of Jackie Robinson is better than anything the statistics would tell you. And the same for Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron and any great player. And I don't understand why now we still don't have an agreement on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think when you think about the history of baseball, you know, history is narrative too. History is not, you know, just that, you know, Independence Day is July 4th. I mean, what happened on July 4th? And what were people risking on July 4th?
Right.
I mean, and what did they say about, you know, we may all hang together when Benjamin Franklin said that. So we'll either hang separately or all hang together. I mean, that's a very risky personal people moment on the 4th of July. And when you think about the life of Jackie Robinson, which goes beyond, you know, numbers that he put on the field, being an MVP and all that. I mean, he was the first African-American coach and broadcaster. I mean, he did a lot of things. He really did. And but the person of Jackie, clearly more important than the numbers.
It's interesting because I don't remember, Dave, if it was you that brought it up or Ranji that brought it up too, but like we haven't had enough of the conversation either of all of those records being achieved in a time when a lot of the greatest players in the sport could not play Major League Baseball, so the competition was not as good as it could have been.
It's a little harsh for me to say it, and I probably get people don't like it when I say that, but I've said several times in the past that Babe Ruth, you know, hit 60 home runs against white Americans. Because that's what he did, and it wasn't even players from Japan or players from South Korea or wherever that players are now. It was not. It really is a World Series now.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is, and that's I think a good summary of it.
Rick, I have a Dave question for you, and there's no better person to ask than you. I'm no Wheeler or Horton, but I consider myself fairly knowledgeable about baseball, and I have a friend who's really new to it, really didn't play as a kid, and is kind of getting into it, and he asked me, well, why are some guys starters and some guys are closers? And I gave him what I thought was a really good answer, and he just looked at me blankly. So let me ask you, what makes a starter? Are they made? Are they created? Are you born?
Well, there's two different things I would say, and if you're talking to a novice about it, just the simplest thing to say is relievers have two really good pitches, and starters typically have three or four.
Oh,
that's the first.
There you go.
So relievers are just going to be out there for 12 pitches. So here it is. Here's 98. Here's a nasty slider. That's it. Secondarily, some people are physically just different in terms of being able how often you can throw.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some guys can throw every day. But not as hard, and other guys can throw harder, but only every other day. And so you kind of have to kind of work that through in terms of what a starter is more of a, I guess, more of an endurance athlete, mm-hmm. and a reliever is more of a sprinter. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it, because I think one thing we're understanding better now, Rick, when it comes to training athletes, and it's one of the reasons why more pitchers can maximize performance, is that we can understand, okay, a lot of this is about how your body moves. How does your body move, and what can we do to make that better, as opposed to here's a cookie cutter thing and everybody's got to be like that. And we understand now that even with hitting, everybody moves a little differently, and it's some of it's just genetic.
So why is the punter and the middle linebacker the middle linebacker?
Right.
I mean, I think we'd all would say, okay, I get it. There's body kind of awareness, there's physique, there's speed, there's quickness that are different in those two positions, and leg strength versus, you know, just being bigger and stronger. And so some of that is you can't kind of make somebody that way. They are. But what you do is you try to identify them. I actually sat at a spring training game with Bill Parcells once, and he was looking at all the Cardinal players telling me what position they would play if they were a football player. And it was the coolest thing. He said, oh, that guy's a middle linebacker. Oh, that guy's a tight end. And it's funny because he could just tell by body type.
Yeah, and how they move.
Yeah, exactly. Rick, one of the coolest things ever, Mark Bolger is one of my best friends, and when he was playing for the Rams, he was injured, and I sat in his suite with him, and he had all the plays the Rams were going to run. And he would be like, okay, this is going to be the red X19, and here's what's going to happen. Then it would happen on the field, and I was like, it was just so cool.
Such a great guy, too. I know Mark also, and not like you do, but I love being around him. I know he loves to golf, and he's just a kind of an understated guy, but what a terrific athlete.
When Mark and I raised $400,000 to redo the USO back in 2008. And we did it. Yeah. That was before the meltdown. And we did it in one night, big shindig we put on. And we did it ourselves. And he was calling places to get prices on tablecloths and cutlery. And they would hang up on him because they didn't think it was really Mark Bolger. And then in true Bolger fashion, we raised $400,000. And we met with the engineers, and they said, we really need $500,000, and we're at a breakfast. And I was doing what I do, which was putting pen to paper and coming up with ideas to get another $100,000, and I heard a check ripping, and he just wrote a check for $100,000.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. You know, so back to the earlier conversation, you can give me Mark Bulger's numbers. How many touchdowns did he throw? I mean, you know, what? How many games did he win, et cetera? But you just told everybody something a lot more important about Mark Bulger than numbers.
So I think Goldie is a Mark Bulger. He's just a just a solid guy, and I'm fascinated by Wainwright. I'm not sure if Wainwright was talking out of school or not, but when he told Tommy Ackerman that he texted him and said, we're going to win the division, how'd that hit you?
Well, it hit me, first of all, Goldie probably didn't want him saying that. That's number one, knowing Goldie. But secondarily, it doesn't surprise me that he thought that, because there is a different feel going on. And, you know, for Goldie to say it, I think the whole point of that Tom and Adam were saying is that for Goldie to say it, he's not just going to say something for fluff. He says it because he means it. And so, you know, the old E.F. Hutton commercial, I mean, I feel like that is, you can take that to the bank that's what he thinks.
It is fun, too, because we were talking about it yesterday, Rick, that you're kind of reset now, right? It's like almost opening day again as you're getting ready to start June. You're at 500. Yeah. You're not looking at this big mountain to climb. And if you just play 3-4 games above 500 per month, you'll be in the postseason and probably win the division if you're doing that. And I know that there's the chicken or the egg question about how you play versus how you feel. Because when you're playing well, you're going to feel good. And sometimes it's also the other way around. When you're feeling good, you're going to play better. This team seems to finally be feeling good, and I don't think it's a coincidence that these two things are going together.
Well, I think they're feeling good because the corner infielders, the all-stars, are feeling better, both Arenado and Goldschmidt. And I think the feeling that they have is going to affect everybody else because everybody cares about them, and they know that they're the guys. And so I think that was part of why we weren't in a good place and why we are now. Yesterday, by the way, we didn't send out any invitations to any parties, but it was multiply times 3 day because it was actually the first third of the season was over yesterday. So you think about all the numbers that guys have for numbers, people like me, you multiply it times 3, that's the kind of year you have. But the Cardinals finish it, you know, the first third of the season at 500, I think people would have to say that's pretty good considering the start.
I mean, that's the hard part, right, is digging out of the hole. So you filled the hole, and then now you build on that from there. And you know, you mentioned the two stars, Rick. I think what's been fun in the month of May is that some guys that you've been counting on, the younger guys, have really put up numbers. I mean, Gorman's been hitting for crazy power. Lars Nootbaar's hitting for power and getting on base. And all of this has been without Wilson Contreras, who was the best hitter on the team when he got hurt.
Yeah, so you're going to get better when he comes back, and I think you'll get better when Tommy Edman comes back, whenever that's going to be. And then the two names that you didn't say that have been as steady as anybody on the offensive side are Mason Wynn and Alec Burleson. Alec Burleson, I mean, I'm careful because you don't want to be Tony La Russa and start saying, you know, who's your favorite child kind of deal. You know, they're all tied for first. But I'm going to say it. I believe Alec Burleson is the best hitter on the Cardinals team.
Dude,
and really has been.
Me too.
Yeah, even before anybody would say that, he's just a guy that can flat out hit. He's got that gift of putting the bat to the ball and hitting it hard, and he's fun to watch.
We've talked about before, like when I played football and soccer especially, and we've talked about this, you get to know your teammates, and you don't have to see their number. You see their outline, and you know whether you can trust them to make a pass or not. When Burleson is up to bat, I just know he's going to hit it hard.
Yeah, so bottom of the ninth, two outs, bases loaded, who do you want it to play?
Yeah,
I mean, he's my answer. He really is. Now there are other guys I'd feel good about too, and maybe Donovan even comes to mind. But honestly, my number one answer would be Burley.
All right, buddy, enjoy that day off and have a great call tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Good to visit with you.
When I wake up in good one. I thought that was this song. Andrew, what's wrong with your eye?
I don't know.
Uh-oh.
It's driving me nuts.
What are the symptoms?
My eyelid hurts and it's swollen.
You got a sty?
Maybe. I don't know what that is.
I do.
What
I
is
do
it?
Too.
What is it?
Well, I don't know what it is organically, but Rage gets them. I get them. We can look at it for you.
Yeah.
We'll diagnose. Come on
this,
in.
This one's like swollen, and it's like swollen enough that it's like a little hard to see out of the side.
Sounds like a sty.
Yeah. And then this one's fine.
Yeah.
Isn't a sty like a blocked tear duct?
It's something. So. It's something like that. Like something's blocked and there's a buildup and it hardens. And
if Dr. Birdie is listening, he'll text me.
Yeah, he was very nice when I had my sty earlier this year.
What did you do for it?
I just did a warm compress, like they said, and it...
No one's going to do a warm compress like this guy's going to do a warm compress, right?
My life is a warm compress.
So the orange juice crisis, what's going on?
There's like a huge shortage of oranges in Brazil is the main country that orange juice comes from and oranges.
Who knew?
And there's like no oranges there this year.
You know what that reminds me of? Not to just take your segment here, but... Did you guys see that, like, a couple hours away, the chicken farm that burned?
I saw this on Twitter.
A million chickens.
What?
They talked about a million eggs and a million chickens. A million. 1 million wow. chickens and a million eggs. And then they're doing the story, and they said, and thankfully no one was hurt. I mean, that's a much different story on the Chicken Network.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, I think.
A million living things burned up.
A million chickens is pretty bad.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Rich.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's just always really sad whenever it's like, we've discovered a new flu, so we're killing 300,000 of this type of bird. You know, it's like, it's just so sad.
Mm-hmm. Beals, anyway. How many Taco Bell tacos could you eat in an hour?
All right, though, this is the question. So I want to, if you guys can answer that, like, just simply, if I said, how many Taco Bell tacos could you eat in an hour, what would your number be?
Probably 10. 10 or 12. If it was like a contest, mm-hmm. I'm not worried about calories or anything like that.
Right. I don't think I could go above 15.
Okay.
I don't want to get myself into a situation here. I could do 20. An hour is a long time.
It is a long time.
It is. And I'd say I'm probably in that 12 to 15 range too. Like, I think that's probably, yeah, assuming that you're like normal hungry, right?
Is pushing.
You're not, you didn't just eat. You've been waiting a little bit. You're going to eat. Because the way this was put was if you had to pick a number of tacos that you could eat in an hour, but if you fail, you're dead.
No.
Oh
geez. Well, you should have started with that.
Andrew, this on the show tomorrow.
The whole exercise is how much does it change your answer?
Yeah. That's interesting.
When there's actually a consequence versus if you go over it. You get $100,000 for everyone over.
Ooh.
Oh, well, then the answer should be one for everyone.
No, it's got to be an honest answer.
I don't understand. Why? Yeah, okay, one. That's honest.
Like you do when you're doing taco competitions.
That's why I asked the question without telling you the criteria, because I wanted to know what you think you could do. And then once we establish that number, then the challenge ensues. Obviously, it's a fantasy challenge.
Yeah.
I'm still sticking with 10 to 12.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think 12 to me feels like it would be easy. I mean, I can knock out 3 in like 5 minutes.
I mean, if I'm going to die, it gets easier.
If it's to save my life.
And now again, I put it as Taco Bell tacos. Other people were just
Which
putting it as regular
too. More of Taco Bell tacos or White Castle sliders?
Oh, the tacos for sure.
Yeah, me too.
I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nothing against the sliders. I like tacos better.
Back when I used to get Taco Bell and not care about being fat, I would get 8 to 10 items. And I've said this before, I can leave a McDonald's hamburger. I can't leave a Taco Bell item. I just can't do it. I can't throw away a bag.
So like once you've started, you're eating it.
I'm eating it. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I'm with you. But I pretty much have a good gauge on, you know, like when I order something from Taco Bell, like I know I'll finish it.
You're a Taco Bell guy.
Yeah. I mean, forever. Like going back to high school, that's where we hung out. Like all groups of us would go there, and back then when
remember
they were like
how glamorous it was.
Oh, I know. Like, oh, it's so different because everything was
I
burger
love
places.
Mexican food. Where's your favorite place? The Bell.
Taco Bell.
Do you remember the thing? It was like water and little shelves in the water tank, and you would put your quarter in there and try to catch it on the shelf, and then you'd get like a free taco.
That may have been
they had that on the counter, right?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't an Alton only thing.
No,
okay,
it was an Alton exclusive.
We had that in Detroit. And we used to, like, the best thing was it was the only place that had Mountain Dew. So for all of us that were teenage boys and we had our cars, we wanted to get Mountain Dew. And then you could eat 10 tacos for like $5 back then.
I remember they had, they would shoot the sour cream out of a caulking gun.
Yes.
Remember that?
I think they still,
do they still do that?
We need one of those. When someone else instead of me.